This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Neil Conan is away. There's a lot of political gossip in a new book by Mark Halperin and John Heilman. Infighting in the Edwards family, Hillary Clinton's hubris and her husband's liabilities, Sarah Palin unable to say Joe Biden's last name, and Senator Harry Reid's now infamous remark about Barack Obama. It's Wednesday, time for a game change edition of The Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
Every Wednesday, NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us to talk about politics. We've got the Senate race in Massachusetts being closer than anyone expected. Former Tennessee Congressman Harold Ford Jr. may run for Senate again, but this time in New York. Sarah Palin is joining the Fox News payroll. President Obama plans to address House Democrats and Republicans. And a group of Wall Street executives is on Capitol Hill. Later, John Heilman, co-author of Game Change, will join us. We'll have an update on the earthquake in Haiti, and we'll read from your letters. But first, as usual, we begin with a trivia question. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us here in Studio 3A. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Rebecca. What a week. What a day. What a week. Here's a convoluted political trivia question. Okay, Harold Ford Jr., who ran for the Senate from Tennessee back in 2006, as you say, seriously considering running against Kirsten Gillibrand in New York this year. In the past, there have been statewide elected officials from one state who later ran for statewide office in another state. Name the last Democrat and the last Republican to do that.
So if you think you know the last Democrat and Republican elected in one state who later ran for statewide office in another state, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or email us talk@npr.org. So let's run through a couple of these surprising races, starting with Massachusetts, which is a much closer race than anyone expected it to be. Everyone thought it was a walkaway for the Democrat to replace Senator Kennedy.
Right. Well, Martha Coakley won the primary, the Democratic primary, back on December 8th and basically has slept since then. She has not aggressively campaigned for the seat. A lot of people said she was a slam dunk. No Republican has won a Senate seat in Massachusetts since 1972. But the Republican, Scott Brown, has been very energetic. His backers are energized. The Tea Party people are very active in Massachusetts. And only in the last second, it seems like the Democrats realize that they have a real race on their hands. Now, of course, if Scott Brown does win, and I don't think he does, the election is 6 days away, January 19th. But if he does win, and obviously it's good news for Republicans in November, bad, nervous signs for the Democrats. But also, he becomes the 41st Republican in the Senate. And if that's the case, then the Democrats no longer have the 60 votes they need to pass health care, for example. Now, it'll be very interesting to see how long they keep Scott Brown, should he win, from being sworn in, because Paul Kirk, who's the appointee after Ted Kennedy died, Paul Kirk says he's voting for it, and whether or not Scott Brown wins. There was a Boston Globe poll last Sunday that showed Coakley up by 15 points. There's a Rasmussen poll that some Democrats, they question the methodology, but they have that poll is out today, has Coakley up by 2 points. 3 points go to this independent candidate by the name of Joe Kennedy, no relation, and he's a libertarian, not a liberal, but he's certainly no relation to the Kennedy family. But it's just wild in Massachusetts and something the Democrats never thought would happen.
Well, when Massachusetts has elected a Republican statewide, it's someone like Mitt Romney, who is not from the far right of the Republican Party. What do you know about the politics of this candidate?
Well, Scott Brown is pretty conservative. He's voted against certain he's voted in favor of abortion restrictions in some legislation in the past. But he is trying to sell himself as more of a moderate Republican than his record in the state Senate would indicate. He's talking about new leadership, and he's talking about in general terms like that. He says that he would support abortion rights. He's suddenly sounding more pro-choice than he really is. But in a sense, he's just a fresh face. Now, not that Martha Coakley's been around forever. She was elected state attorney general only in 2006, just 4 years ago. So she's not, like Ted Kennedy, who had been in the Senate for 47 years. But she's just not inspiring voters. I mean, she's a woman. There are women's groups out to do everything they can for her. She's just not running an inspired campaign. Still, I think the demographics in Massachusetts have to portend a Coakley victory. But, you know, we've seen stranger things happen.
Well, do you think her lack of effort since the primary explains most of why this is so close, or is something else going on?
Well, there is a general anti-democratic mood. I don't know if you'll see it in Massachusetts as much. I do know that Governor Deval Patrick is also in some kind of trouble in the state seeking a second term. But also the fact that I think she's just not as good candidate as Democrats had hoped. She won the Democratic primary pretty convincingly. Scott Brown, of course, is running a much better campaign than many thought. But the DSCC, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, has now running negative ads in Massachusetts against Scott Brown, which makes me think they're a little more nervous than they would be. President Obama will not campaign in Massachusetts, but Bill Clinton will be campaigning on behalf of Martha Coakley on Friday.
So moving on to New York, Harold Ford Jr., former congressman from Tennessee from an old Memphis political family, is considering a Senate run in New York.
Which is very strange because New York never elects carpetbaggers.
No,
unless,
never.
Unless we're talking about Hillary Clinton
would be unprecedented
and
project.
Bobby Kennedy and Jim Buckley. No, but look, Harold Ford Jr. moved to New York after he lost his 2006 Senate race in Tennessee. He works for what was then Merrill Lynch, now I guess Bank of America, as vice chairman. He's a good campaigner, an attractive candidate. Or to quote Joe Biden, he's attractive and smart and clean. But more importantly, he has some pretty conservative views. He has called himself pro-life when he was running for the Senate in Tennessee. He has voted against same-sex marriage. And the Kirsten Gillibrand people say that, you know, this guy is not fit for New York State, which is interesting because when Kirsten Gillibrand was in the House, now she's a senator, having been appointed to replace Hillary Clinton, but when she was in the House, she also voted, you know, on certain issues like on guns, which were popular upstate New York, but not popular statewide. So she also has an old record that she has to distance herself from.
And what are Democratic Party leaders in New York making of this potential fight?
They do not want Harold Ford in this race, and the White House has made it clear. Robert Gibbs, the press secretary to the White House press secretary, said this week there was no question about where the White House stood on that.
We have that tape. Let's listen.
Robert, it looks like Harold Ford is very serious about jumping into the Senate race in New York. What's the White House's position on having a candidate like Harold Ford run for that Senate seat?
I think the White House is quite happy with the leadership and the representation of Senator Gillibrand in New York. And as many are in the DSCC, we're supporting her reelection. Thanks, guys.
How would you handicap chances of Rahm and Senator Schumer to clear the field this time around?
Stay tuned.
That's White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs in a briefing yesterday.
There were a bunch of congressmen, members of Congress from New York who wanted to run against Gillibrand because, of course, she was appointed by who is now a very unpopular governor, David Patterson. And Schumer and the White House just pushed them out. They said, no, we want to clear the field for Gillibrand. And now, of course, the Republican Party, you know, you think that a fight in the Democratic Party could help the GOP gain a seat. There is really no Republican candidate worth anything in this race. There's a guy named Bruce Blakeman who ran for something once upon a time and lost badly. So it's not a question of what the Republicans can do to this seat in November. But the Democrats really want it to be Gillibrand, and they're very angry at Ford. Ford says, like, I'm not going to be, you know, pushed over by these bullies. You know, I'm not going to be a rubber stamp for Harry Reid. He's almost sounding like a Republican in the fact that he's standing up to Schumer, the White House, and Reid. And it's really weird to hear those kind of words coming from a Democrat.
I want to get some trivia answers in, but I quickly want to ask, you talked about a potential Republican pickup in Massachusetts, but of course there is an election coming up in the fall that is another chance for Republican pickups. And last week you talked about two Senate retirements in North Dakota and Connecticut. Any update on those?
The update this week in North Dakota, John Hoeven, as expected, the very popular three-term Republican governor, has announced his candidacy. That is the one Senate seat that looks like almost assuredly will go from D to R in November. Hoeven is very popular. The likely Democratic candidate was Congressman Earl Pomeroy, who has since announced he will not run. The Democrats still don't have a candidate there. But good news for the Democrats in Connecticut. Chris Dodd was in big trouble. The state attorney general, Richard Blumenthal, will be the Democratic nominee and probably will keep the seat for the Democrats in that state.
We have a couple of potential responses to the trivia question here. This is, we're asking for the last Democrat and Republican elected in one state who later ran for statewide office in another state. Let's hear from George in Tallahassee. George, what's your answer to the trivia question?
My answers would be Alan Keyes in Illinois, who ran against Obama, and I think it was Indicate Peabody in New Hampshire, the Democrat.
Well, first of all, Endicott Peabody is the correct answer, and I never thought anybody would get that answer, but Endicott Peabody was a former governor of Massachusetts who ran for the Senate in 1986 in New Hampshire, and of course everybody knows Endicott Peabody was named after three cities in Massachusetts, Endicott, Peabody, and Marblehead. That's an old joke. But anyway, but Alan Keyes is not the correct answer because I'm looking for somebody who had been elected statewide.
To anything ever.
And Alan Keyes was never elected to anything, although he did move to Illinois to run against some guy named Barack Obama in 2004.
George, since you got Endicott Peabody, congratulations on that one. I'm going to put you on hold and see if anybody can get the Republican answer correct. Let's see if Casey in Green Bay, Wisconsin knows the answer. Hey, Casey.
Okay. How you doing?
Good. What's your answer?
Well, I'm glad Mr. Peabody's name came up because I had the wrong one. So I will go with Mr. Peabody as Democrat, and then the Republican, it has to be the illustrious, well, I almost forgot his name, Arnold Schwarzenegger, because he came from a foreign country and got elected.
Yes.
California governorship.
Yes, but the question was, who have been, I needed a statewide elected official from one state who ran as for statewide official in another state, and Schwarzenegger was never elected before he came to California.
Let's try Al in Nashville, Tennessee. Al, do you know the answer to the Republican part of this question?
I think I do. I think it was one of our United States senators here from Tennessee, Bill Brock. He was elected, I think, in 1970 and served. He lost election for a second term, and then he later moved to Maryland, and he ran for the United States Senate from Maryland. I think he lost that election.
And that is a correct answer. Bill Brock lost, beat some guy named Albert Gore Sr., 1970, lost in Tennessee, came back to Maryland, and lost in 1994.
Well, another Al from Nashville will get the prize there. And coming up, we are going to talk a little bit more about the 2008 election. It's coming back to haunt us in the form of a book, Game Change. We'll talk with one of the co-authors. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. And Ken Rudin stays with us for the rest of the Political Junkie segment. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. It's Political Junkie Day. We've got Ken Rudin with us. And a new book about the 2008 presidential campaign came out this week. It's based on 300 interviews, and it's called Game Change, Obama and the Clintons, McCain and Palin, and the Race of a Lifetime. Some of the stories in it have already caused a stir, most notably Harry Reid's comment in 2008 that then-candidate Barack Obama showed promise in part because he is, quote, light-skinned with no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. There's also descriptions of Sarah Palin struggling to understand the differences between North Korea and South Korea. In just a minute, we'll speak with one of the authors of Game Change, John Heilman. But if you have questions for him about the 2008 campaign or about the book, we want to hear from you. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. John Heilman is a national political correspondent and columnist for New York Magazine and the co-author with Mark Halperin of Game Change. He joins us now from his studio in New York City. John Heilman, it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
It's great to be back.
So did you expect the furor over some of the comments in this book, and did you pick the right comments to have potential furor?
Well, it has been surprising in the sense that I don't think we were pretty confident that we'd written a really good book, and we hoped we had at least. And we also thought that there were some things that were newsworthy in the book. I don't think that you can predict this kind of a firestorm any more than you can predict where lightning will strike. You know, the Harry Reid comments that you mentioned have obviously gotten a lot of attention. We think that they, whatever you think of them and the controversy around them, they've kind of obscured the larger story about Harry Reid, the more newsworthy story, which is his role in secretly urging Senator Obama to run for president while maintaining his public neutrality throughout the Democratic race. And he was a very important figure in among a number of senators and a large number of members of the Democratic establishment who urged Senator Obama when he was only 18 months in office to take on Hillary Clinton. That's a pretty big story in the grand arc of history, and that's one of the most important stories in the book. And I think that this piece of news is slightly distracted from that news. But we welcome all attention, I suppose.
Well, the larger narrative of the book is the transformation of Barack Obama from candidate into president-elect.
Yes.
How would you chart that change?
Well, it's one piece of the book. I mean, the book covers the entire 2008 election, and part of the reason why we sat down to write it in the first place was that, as we say, as the subtitle indicates, we thought it was the race of a lifetime, and there were so many pieces of it that were historic. I don't think we'll ever see an election like this in our lifetimes again, where you have the election of the first African American president, the first female plausible female candidate for president in Hillary Clinton, the rise of Sarah Palin, which has obviously led to a whole movement in the Republican Party that's kind of transforming the Republican Party. Those are all big pieces. You also had John McCain, who in any normal year would have been would have been a vast kind of celebrity figure and the most interesting person in the race. In this campaign, he was the fourth or fifth most interesting person in the race. But as you point out, the arc of Obama, the unknown Barack Obama coming to the Senate and getting it into his head that he can win against the formidable frontrunner Hillary Clinton, how he did that and how the two of them end up on the same side at the end of the book is obviously probably the overarching single most kind of historically important narrative in the entire book.
Ken Reed.
John, what I found so fascinating about this book is that, one, before I opened it, I figured, look, here we go again. We know everything that happened. Some guy named Obama won. We know the other people lost, and that would be the end of it. And yet I could not, and I still haven't, been able to put this book down. I also want to say it's really well written, and it's a great book. What I found most fascinating, not only watching the Obama think, the way the Obama people thought about whether he could actually run and win, but to watch what Hillary Clinton had to go through, knowing the vulnerabilities, knowing the problems with Bill Clinton, and yet how she so carefully tried to make herself the inevitable candidate and watch it fall apart on her face.
Yeah, Ken, very nice of you to say that the book is readable, and we certainly tried to make it that way. We were, stunned, I think, throughout the reporting of the book. And as one of you mentioned earlier, we did a lot of reporting on the book, 300 interviews with more than 200 sources. And Mark and I had both covered the campaign. We covered it pretty carefully, and I think we thought we knew. We didn't think there were that many secrets to be unearthed. We didn't think there was that much. We hoped we could find out new things, but we were shocked day in and day out throughout the reporting how much stuff we didn't know, how much stuff we could bring to light that was the back behind the scenes story of this campaign that was new to us. And I would say that in that context, the stories inside the Clinton world, we penetrated into the Clinton's world in a way I think very few authors ever have before. And the story that you tell there, again, another historic theme of this book is, the fall of the House of Clinton, and they had been the dominant family in American politics for the past generation, and how Hillary Clinton missed her opportunity in 2004. One of the big pieces of news in the book that's also been ignored a little bit is how close she came to running, Hillary did, in 2004. We argue in the book that she was probably a better chance for her than in 2008, and in some ways, by not running in 2004, she opened the door to Barack Obama. She opened the door to John Kerry getting the nomination, who then named Obama his keynote speaker in 2004, how she then decides, having not run in 2004, that 2008 will be her year and goes through, as you said, all of the vulnerabilities, fights them all off, fends off the concerns about her husband, fends off all of those problems, manages to put herself in this, what it seems to be an unassailable frontrunner's position, and then manages to see it all snatched away by this most unlikely challenger in the person of Barack Obama.
And the other thing I saw that really stayed with me and struck me was, even though most people don't even think about John and Elizabeth Edwards anymore, and Democrats would rather not think about John and Elizabeth Edwards, the public perception and the campaign perception of Elizabeth Edwards was just startling to read.
I think that's true. I mean, Mark and I were sort of stunned when we started talking to people in the Edwards circle, both John Edwards' circle and Elizabeth Edwards' circle, they all kind of had a universal, unanimous view, which was that in the case of Elizabeth Edwards, there was no person for whom the gap between public perception and private reality was greater. I would say, you know, the Edwardses are, I'm still surprised by what a resonant figures they both are. You know, last in December, just last month, the Wall Street Journal did a poll that showed that John Edwards was the most disappointing public figure in American life in 2009, that he had beaten Tiger Woods for that honor, that dubious distinction, by 2-1, which tells you that even though he never really ended up not coming close to winning the White House, even a year and a half later, after much of the story about him was known, people are still intensely interested in the Edwardses. And I think we were able to show, especially in him, that he is kind of the he's like an exaggerated version of all the qualities that lead someone to run for president in the first place. I mean, there's a lot of ego, a lot of vanity, a lot of hubris, a certain amount of neediness, a certain amount of delusion in every presidential candidate. And John Edwards was all of those things times 10 to the point of self-destructiveness. And so I think in some ways his story is an archetypal story. And in the book, in Game Change, we take you very deep inside and show you all of those qualities at a very, very profoundly human level.
I want to take a call, actually. This is Paulie in Wilmington, North Carolina. Paulie, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Hey. I just, I saw you on TV describing a really personal moment where Elizabeth Edwards had a meltdown, and I just thought, exactly where were your sources for that? But I assume you and your co-author didn't witness it personally, and you described it compassionately, but it just seems like an incredibly intense private moment that I question how accurate your retelling of it could be.
What scene are you referring to?
Where she apparently has a meltdown and tears at her blouse and cries out that this is me, or
where she says, "Look at me." That was not a moment where John and Elizabeth Edwards were alone, and in fact, they were accompanied at that moment by several aides, who all witnessed the moment. It was actually in a public parking lot in the private aviation terminal in Raleigh, Durham. So. I can attest for you that we had that from multiple sources, all of whom saw the same thing and told us the same story. And as I say, it was not actually a moment of a private moment or a moment just between the two members of the couple.
Well, that brings up a question of your sourcing philosophy, because one of the reasons the book is readable is that it reads as a narrative, and you say, you know, a character thought something or they realized something rather than direct quotes. Can you tell us what your sourcing philosophy was here and why there's not, say, a footnotes or a bibliography?
Right. Well, we say in the book, a couple of things. This is not an unusual technique, and you can look at it from people like Bob Woodward in the politics to people in business like Andrew Ross Sorkin, who just wrote this great book, Too Big to Fail. You know, constructing nonfiction narrative, especially from an omniscient point of view, trying to write like a novel. Many people do the same thing that we did, which was to offer to do all of our interviews on deep background with our sources and to offer our sources anonymity. We still maintain the highest levels of sourcing, so we would still, unless it was something that someone directly told us about themselves. If somebody said to us, "I said the following," we took their word for that. We didn't need to get a second source for that. But if someone said, "I thought the following," you attributed that to them as state of mind. But in terms of other factual stuff and overheard conversations, we would always look for multiple sources. We had known all these sources for a very long time. Mark and I have covered politics for a long time, so we had, in most cases, had long-term relationships with the sources that we were talking to. We were able to judge their veracity, and we knew what the axes were that they had to grind. If they had them to grind, we knew where their weak spots were, and we were scrupulous about trying to make sure that we included nothing in the book that was even in dispute. If there was something that happened in a scene where there was fundamental disagreement about it in the scene, we just didn't write it. We wrote things that where there was fundamental agreement among multiple sources about the things that happened, or where it was only one person attesting to something that they thought or felt, in which case we could rely on them as the single source.
Although, of course, keeping your sources anonymous and on deep background allows for instance, Sarah Palin the other night said, "Well, of course I know the difference between North Korea and South Korea. That just didn't happen." And if you don't have a named source, it allows someone now to say it didn't happen that way. What's your reaction to that?
It's true. And I mean, Sarah Palin took issue with a number of things on television the other night. All I can say is that in the case of Sarah Palin is that we again, what kind of like the Clintons, I think we penetrated into Sarah Palin's world in a way that very few others have. We spoke to, as you probably know, there were warring camps within the McCain campaign. There were people who were very sympathetic to Sarah Palin. There were people who were also very who were very critical of Sarah Palin. We spoke to all of them, and on every single story of a factual nature of the kind that we're talking about here, things that were gaps in her knowledge, we had confirmations on those stories from people who were in both camps, people who were critics and people who were sympathetic. And so I understand why she feels the need to deny those stories because they're embarrassing. But we're very comfortable with them and feel that we stand by them 100%.
I want to get another caller in here. This is Josiah in Cheshire, Connecticut. Josiah, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm glad to hear you discussing the larger themes of the book because my question was less about the contents of the book than the response among the commentariat to the revelations. And I was wondering if both the author and your commentators could discuss why there's been so much more discussion of Senator Reid's infelicitous phrasing of something where he was actually saying, I think the country is ready for Barack Obama, than about something like Sarah Palin thinking that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11. These seem to me to be... I don't really understand why we're having the conversations that we're having and we're not having some of the other conversations coming out of this book.
Josiah, thanks for your call. The book is Game Change, and the author is John Heilman. He's the co-author with Mark Halperin, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. John Heilman, let's give you a chance to respond to that. Have you been frustrated with what has been pulled out and gotten attention this week?
Well, it's hard to complain about anything that gives
it does seem churlish,
so,
yeah.
Well, it's so hard in this world. I mean, selling books is hard. I mean, getting people to read. I mean, we think of our book as a really serious piece of work. We've taken this election very seriously, and we think we've produced something that will inform future historians. I mean, there is stuff in the book that I think if we hadn't gotten it onto the page, it would have been lost to history because memories falter and people forget key details and key scenes. We've tried to. We talked to people immediately after these events took place in the nomination fights in the summer of 2008. Once they were over, we talked to people about that, and then when the general election was over in November of 2008, we started our research on that. So people's memories refresh, and we've got stuff in the book that I think would have been otherwise lost. You know, you're trying to do a serious thing when you do a book like this, and to get people's attention, to get people to pay attention and to go and buy the book, you can't really complain. It's a hard thing to do. And so you can't complain when people pay attention to it. And we're really grateful that people are paying attention to it. I would say that much of the commentary about the book in the last few days has been driven by some of these news revelations. And some of them are very interesting. But many people who are commenting on the book have not read the book. And the book's been very hard to find this week because it's sold very well. And many of the people who are commenting have a perception of what the book is like based on the little tiny pieces of news they've read. And I urge people to actually read the book because it is not that much of the stuff. I'm not backing away from any of the news in the book, but I am saying that it is a kind of a sweeping narrative of the campaign. And I think that that people before they render judgment on the nature of the book should get the book and read the book and then come to some conclusions. And I think they'll find it's a very rich and interesting narrative beyond the specific news nuggets that some people have focused on in the first 72 hours.
Several quick things. First of all, when I knew about the Harry Reid quote and when I read in the book, looking in the book, it seemed so unintrusive and unimportant. It just seemed like a thing. You wonder why a Senate Majority Leader would say the name Negro in 21st century to a reporter, no less. But that's another thing. And I think it has resulted in a valid question on whether there's a double standard. Of course, both sides disagree on it. But in the scheme of things, I thought it was very odd that they would focus on the Harry Reid quote because obviously, as we talked about in the last couple of minutes, there's so much more things here that I never knew existed in that campaign.
And as I said before, you know, I mean, Harry Reid's part of a really important story in the book. It's certainly the case that the word is an anachronistic word, and we understand, Mark and I both understand why it strikes some people as problematic. But you're 100% right in the sense that that we think it's unfortunate that the focus on it has taken away some of the focus on the much bigger, I think, and more historically important story, which is the role that Harry Reid played in getting Obama into the race. And I can't overstate how important it was. I mean, Barack Obama had been in the Senate for 18 months. Harry Reid calls him to his office and says, "You should run." And Obama can't really believe it and goes back to his Senate office and goes back to Chicago and tells people, the Senate Majority Leader wants me to run for president.
And we have to leave it there. John Hallman, co-author of Game Change, joined us from a studio in New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, even more with political junkie Ken Rudin, plus your letters and the cartoon controversy on the NPR website. That's all coming up. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking to the political junkie, Ken Rudin. And Ken, there are a few things we didn't get to before. Let's start with the first National Tea Party Convention.
Well, that is coming up, and there's some question about whether this is good news for the Republican Party or bad news for the Republican Party. There are many people in the Tea Party movement who feel that both parties are wrong and should be revamped, and we should start afresh, almost what Ross Perot was talking about in 1992, different ideology, but again, the same non-Democrat, non-Republican kind of theme. So it's coming up, and I think everybody's just bracing to see what effect they have in November 2010 and beyond.
And what's your best guess?
I don't know. I mean, exactly that. Some people say that the more influence the Tea Party has in the Republican Party, the more conservative it makes the party, and the less inclusive or the less reason for more moderates and centrists to be part of. But if you're talking about enthusiasm for politics in 2010, right now it seems, at least as of this moment, right now it seems to be on the right and with these Tea Party people.
When we talk about potential conservative challenges, we're seeing it certainly in Charlie Crist's race in Florida. How is the candidate recruitment on that effort going? Is there a farm team?
Well, there is. There was an article in the paper just the other day talking about, because of this conservative excitement and enthusiasm, there are more and more people willing to run, people without political backgrounds, people who just did not spend their entire life in politics, but people who just, activists, and some people, you always get these letters to the New York Daily News signed fed up. That would be the letter to the editor. And a lot of people are fed up, and we'll see if it results in political growing. But something to worry about, because Charlie Crist, who once upon a time was a very popular governor of Florida, last week, I don't know how much time we need to spend on straw polls, but in Pinellas County, which is St. Petersburg, which is where Charlie Crist is from, which 4 years ago when Charlie Crist ran for governor, he was unanimously backed by the straw poll. He lost 2-1 to Marco Rubio, his conservative opponent for the Senate race, in his own county. So even though there are 4 million Republicans in Florida and there are hundreds of thousands of Republicans in Pinellas County, the fact is that Marco Rubio got the headlines in winning this straw poll, and a lot of moderates are nervous and a lot of conservatives are excited.
We are talking politics with NPR's Ken Rudin. You can join us at 800-989-8255 or send us email talk@npr.org. Before we completely leave the teabag convention, Sarah Palin is the keynote speaker.
Tea Party Convention.
What did I call it?
Something else.
Okay, Tea Party Convention. Excuse me. We will have more on that particular gaffe coming up in our letter segment. But what does Sarah Palin gain by being part of this?
Well, if we're talking about the Tea Party Convention or we're talking about Fox News, I mean, obviously, joining Fox News, she becomes fairer and more balanced, and I think that's always a good thing. But also, the fact is that I'm there are some people who are not convinced that she is looking at 2012, although her contract with Fox News does run out in 2012. This is a movement, part of the Republican Party, that just likes her. They like everything she says, even if they're told that the facts don't line up, and even if she's inaccurate some things. She speaks from the gut. She speaks from the heart. And a lot of these conservatives just feel that she is the real deal. So I mean, look, a year ago, 6 months ago, President Obama was far more popular. The Republicans were in disarray. The Republicans were criticized as the party of Cheney, Gingrich, and Rush Limbaugh, and the Republicans were on their way out. Now there's some kind of ascendancy. It's fluid. It moves around a lot. But right now, that movement of the Republican Party, that wing of the Republican Party, seems to be doing well.
couple of quick check-ins on some other races. Gubernatorial in Colorado, Denver Mayor John Hickenlooper getting in there?
Yes, he announced this week.
Any excuse to say Hickenlooper on the air?
I know your first question is he related to former Iowa Senator Burke B. Hickenlooper? And yes, there is a relation. A lot of people ask me that. He has announced this week, Bill Ritter is the Democratic governor who surprised everybody last week by saying he wouldn't run again. Hickenlooper is very popular, but he's very liberal, and Republicans insist that he can't win statewide. Democrats think they have the best candidate in Hickenlooper.
And New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu there.
Well, Mitch Landrieu is, of course, the brother of Mary Landrieu, the senator, and the son of the last white mayor of New Orleans, Amon Landrieu. And I mentioned white because, as always, the issue of race is always apparent in New Orleans. The leading African-American candidate, dropped out of the race on January 2nd, which makes it look like that there will be a white mayor elected in New Orleans. And the reason, again, that's a big deal because, of course, since Katrina, African-American political power in the city has really diminished tremendously. And even though the business establishment was always white controlled in New Orleans, blacks knew that they had at least the mayor. Ray Nagin, of course, is term limited after 8 years. They've had black mayors for the last 32 years. And if this is the white mayor, this is a real sea change in New Orleans politics.
And Ray Nagin, of course, was reelected post-Katrina, but it was this sort of funny circumstance where the election ended up being on the day of Barack Obama's general election, and people call him accidental.
Yes, but also, you know, the guy he beat 4 years ago was Mitch Landrieu, and there are conservative whites who would rather vote for Ray Nagin than vote for a Landrieu. They just never liked Mitch Landrieu. Landrieu has run twice for mayor, lost both times. This time may be his charm.
And on a national level, President Obama is going to address a Republican retreat. What's that about?
I don't know. Tell me about that. What is it?
He's also
Surprise question from Rebecca.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to stump you. Let me give you something else that we can chew over here. Healthcare. Latest on healthcare.
Well, that I could talk about. Everybody talks about that the real problem is that the House has to concede to the Senate because the Senate has 60 votes. But the House is not – the House Democrats are not united also because the Senate version, of course, doesn't include the public option – has less restrictions on abortion and has a tax on benefits. And the House does not have any of those things. So for all the Harry Reid saying, look, you know, you really should concede to what we are doing because we have a tougher road to hold. Charlie Rangel and the Democrats in the House say, look, we have tough problems, too, on abortion, on taxes and things like that. And they may not have the 218 votes to pass it, but it looks like they won't be a vote until February.
Well, that you could see this coming, right? I mean, ever since the two houses passed their own versions, the reconciliation was always going to be an issue. Why is there still so much space between them?
Well, because 64 Democrats in the House, for example, voted for the Stupak Amendment, which is restricting abortion. And, of course, and if the progressive Democrats or pro-choice Democrats say that if that's in there, we'll walk. And if the pro-lifers say, well, if it's gone, we'll walk. So the Democrats have to worry. You know, once upon a time, we talked about this conference committee, which would have Democrats and Republicans. Now it's just, look, Democrats have this huge majorities in the House and Senate, and yet they still can't get this House health care passed. And if they don't, they risk doing what the Clintons did in 1994 by not passing it in 1994, it helped Republicans pick up major seats in Congress.
Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and our political junkie, joined us here in Studio 3A as he does every Wednesday. You can read his blog and download his podcast at npr.org/junkie. Thanks, Ken.
No more surprise questions, okay, Rebecca?
I promise. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.